Let me again tell you how glad we are to have you this morning, and I hope that you'll open your this evening. Brother Milton Harris is going to be speaking for you. I know you'll look forward to that. Beth and I are going to leave this afternoon and head toward the mountains for a few days and just get away. Not get away from you necessarily, just to get away. That's a way, I think, a better way to say that. But we look forward to that. We always look forward to our time where we can go and do that. So we're going to plan to do that beginning this afternoon. Well, I want to get right to it this morning because I think what I want to say to you this morning from the Word of God is important for all of us to hear. As we think about some things this morning, particularly as it relates to this question, what does God want from me? In our quiet moments of meditation, I think not only this question comes to mind, but this picture. We kind of throw up our hands and we say, Lord, what is it? What is it that you want? And I know we have the Bible. I know we have the Word of God. And I know we are to follow that and we seek to study that and apply that. I get that. But I think there are times in all of our lives where we ask the question of, I want to know what it is that you want from me, and I want to make sure that I'm doing what it is that you want me to do. And so this picture and this question kind of comes to mind. This happens to all of us. It happened to a man named Malcolm Muggeridge. Malcolm Muggeridge was a contemporary of C.S. Lewis, of G.K. Chesterton. He was considered a British journalist. Early in his life, he was an agnostic. And he did a lot of thinking about the very question that I've asked this morning and the question that I think we all have. And during his lifetime, especially toward the latter part of his life, he wrote three books that I have listed on this chart. In 69, there was a book called Jesus Rediscovered that in 2006 was reprinted. It was a book about his reaction and really his coming to a better understanding of who Christ was and about what was his purpose in his own life. And so he not only became, he was not an agnostic, but became a believer. And then in 72, Chronicles of a Wasted Time, he understood that he had spent much of his life doing something that really was wasted. And then in 88, The Spiritual Journey of a 20th Century Pilgrim. I must tell you that while I would not agree with some of his and probably even much of his theology, Muggeridge did what a lot of us do and what I wish a lot more people would do. He asked good questions and he tried to make some sense out of what he found. And so when he asked those questions, I think he determined, I'm going to find out what the answers are. And he would say things like this once he began to find out these answers. He would say things like, when I look back on my life nowadays, which I sometimes do, what strikes me most forcibly about it is that what seemed at the time most significant and seductive now seems really futile and absurd. For instance, success in all its various guises, being known and being praised, ostensible pleasures like acquiring money or seducing women or traveling, going to and fro in the world and up and down in it like Satan, exploring and experiencing whatever Vanity Fair has to offer. In retrospect, all these exercises in self-gratification seem pure fantasy. That is the reality. And at some point, everybody, I think, reaches that conclusion. He reached it at a little bit later period in his life, but as an intellectual and as someone who, prior to that, was pursuing all the things he mentioned, he finally came to that conclusion. It's just self-gratification, and it's fantasy. It's not reality. Or this statement that he also made, behind the debris of these self-styled, sullen supermen and imperial diplomats, he was thinking of others, there stands the gigantic figure of one person, because of whom and by whom and in whom and through whom alone mankind might still have hope. The person Jesus Christ. Not everybody reaches the conclusion that Muggeridge reached. probably not everybody even thinks about the conclusions that he's reached. But I want to suggest something to you this morning, and that is that not having the foundation that says God exists and that He has spoken to me through His Son and through all mankind through His Son, not having that foundation to me, when you deny the existence of God and how God speaks to us, you are left with absolutely nothing. You're left with no answers. I just want you to just think this morning, ask yourself, if I weren't a believer, if I had not only already reached these conclusions about having faith and listening to the fact that God has spoken to me through His Son, if you weren't there, if you were considering something else, what hope would you have if you didn't have that? What conclusion would you reach? And so denying the existence of God and denying the fact that He has somehow, at this point we'll say, revealed Himself to us, to deny that means that your life, shall I say, really is meaningless. It offers very little hope for you. So the passage in Hebrews 11, without faith, obviously it's impossible, God says, to please Him. If you're going to please Him, you've got to believe that He is. And you have to believe that He's going to reward those who will diligently seek Him. So, to not believe that gives you what? What does it give you? I can't answer that. I'm not at a meaningless point. I'm at a meaningful point by the mercy and grace of God. But I want to ask you this question. Do you at this point agree with all that? Would you agree this morning to this point with everything that I'm saying? Do you agree that without God and the belief in God and the belief that He somehow revealed Himself to us through the Word, through His Son, without thinking about that, would you agree that life is meaningless? Well, Muggeridge said, yeah, that's a conclusion I've come to. I've lived most of my life pursuing everything in this life that anybody can pursue. And when it's all said and done, it's fantasy. It means nothing, really. And so I want to go back this morning to what I think is the foundation of every lesson. For me practically, it's the foundation. And every lesson that I preach, every statement that I ever make from a spiritual perspective, every time I'm trying to talk to people, and myself included, about the gospel, I can always start with this passage. Always. God said, let us make man in our image, according to our likeness. Let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, over the birds of the air, over the cattle, over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creeps on the earth. So God created man. In His own image and in the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. We are made in God's image. You have heard that all of your life. It is something about which you have no choice. Nobody came to your mother when you were born and said, listen, you got a few minutes to decide whether or not you want your child to be made in God's image. Nobody did that. Nobody could have done that. When you were born as a human being into this world, you were made in God's image. Now that fundamentally changes everything about your life. Automatically. And if you sit here this morning, you say, well, Kenny, I don't care about that. I'm going to tell you right now, I'm so sorry. Because what I'm about to talk to you about finds its foundation in this very point, over which you have no control. You can't deny it. You can't dismiss it. You can't avoid it. You can't get away from it. It's there. So with that in mind, think about what it is that God really does want. Most people don't accept this fact. Most people don't even care to address it. But it's true whether they believe it or not. You may find a professor who is involved in academia not far from this building on a campus that's pretty close to this location. And you may find a professor there who denies the very existence of God. I'm convinced not everyone would. But in a lot of academia, you will find those who do deny that existence. And an attitude surfaces among non-believers that produces a mindset that says, I really don't care. And I'm certainly not going to believe the fact that I am made in God's image. I don't even believe in God, which doesn't do anything to change the fact that you are and that He does exist. But there are people who would take this attitude that's found in Romans 1. We began reading some of that in our class in the auditorium this morning. And part of what an unwillingness to believe in God and believe in faith and to believe in everything that revolves around God, part of that is that, as Paul would say, and even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, God gave them over to a debased mind to do those things which are not fitting. So, in other words, when you or I do not retain God in our knowledge, we will do whatever we want to do, which is what happens, which is what Romans 1 describes. That's exactly what it describes. And what Paul says is, when you refuse to acknowledge God and when you refuse to acknowledge everything about God that He has revealed, you have a debased mind. That's what happens to you. And you do those things that people who understand God and understand faith and understand His Son, you do things that they don't do. At least in theory, that's what happens. And so, back to my question that I asked initially, what does God expect from me? Then, when you have God in your knowledge, there are some things that fit you. It means following Him. It means getting direction from Him. And so the question then that I would ask is, what does He want? And God's messengers have always dealt with that question. Always. Matter of fact, in the prophets in the Old Testament would mention something like Amos mentions here in Amos 5, where he says, this is what God says, I hate. I despise your feast days and I do not savor your sacred assemblies. Which in the common vernacular is, folks, what we're doing right now. Right? Sacred assemblies. He says, though you offer me burnt offerings and your grain offerings, I will not accept them. Which in today's vernacular, in the present day, I'm not going to accept you just because you're here. You see that? He says, I'm not going to accept that. And I'm not going to regard your fattened peace offering. It's not just peace offering. It's fattened peace offering. You have maintained. You have brought before me the very thing which I want. And he says, I despise it. And it's not just Amos who would say this. I mean, Jeremiah would say much the same thing when he says, thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, add your burnt offerings to your sacrifices and eat meat. For I did not speak to your fathers or command them in the day that I brought them out of the land of Egypt concerning burnt offerings or sacrifices. He said, that's not what it's about. But this is what I commanded them, saying, obey my voice and I will be your God and you shall be my people and walk in all the ways that I have commanded you that it may be well with you. And that's what Jeremiah was saying. That the Lord was saying, you see. That's from Jeremiah 7. If you took the time to read Jeremiah, Isaiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, and every one of the major and minor prophets, that's the kind of language you'd see all through it. All through it. So let me ask you another question. How would Jesus answer that? What would Jesus say? Mark records for us in his gospel, Mark records a conversation between Jesus and a scribe who evidently had been listening to what the Sadducees and Jesus were talking about. Because in Mark 12, the scribe asked him a question and Jesus answers this. He says, Jesus answered him, the first of all the commandments is, you need to hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. You shall love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all of your soul, with all your mind, and with all your strength. This is the first commandment. When I ask you the question this morning, what is it that God expects from me? I'm going to suggest to you this morning that this is it. This is what I'm going to suggest. And I'm going to suggest that this is not just to the ones who are in this auditorium. This is to every single person in the world who's ever existed. This is what Jesus said in the first century. But it's what God had said from the get-go. Deuteronomy talks about it all over the place. And the prophets kept going back to, you should have listened. This is what you should have done. This is what should have happened to you. I want to ask you a question about this morning. Why would Jesus say this? Why would Jesus say that the great, of all the commandments, why would Jesus say this is the greatest? The greatest is to love God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. May I ask a question? Why didn't he just say, you ought to love me? Why didn't he just say that? And I'm going to suggest to us, and we're going to look at it for just a minute this morning, I'm going to suggest that the words identify something different. That the words together, though, conclude for us a type of love that is different from anything else we love or we ought to love. They identify different levels and areas where love for God is manifest, or at least it ought to be. So I want us to look briefly at this idea this morning. So what does this loving God business mean? I think that's a good question. And I want to go back again to Deuteronomy to listen to what to think about something which was said. Look at that, if you would. Deuteronomy 7, beginning verse 9. Therefore know that the Lord your God, He is God, the faithful God who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations with those who love Him and keep His commandments. And He repays those who hate Him to their face to destroy them. He will not be slack with him who hates Him. He will repay him to his face. Now, there's a lot in here. There's a whole lot in here. I mean, this is not just a sermon. This is a series of sermons here. But I'm going to make just a couple of points from the passage, if I may. I like the fact that he says this is the God who keeps covenant and mercy for 1,000 generations. Thousands of generations. I don't think he's saying when you get to 1,001 generation, it's done. He's saying this is the way it's always been. This is the way it'll always be. And it's with those who love Him and keep His commandments. Those are the ones on whom He's going to show mercy. And so the latter part of this passage says, though He's going to repay those who hate Him, He's not just going to repay them, He's going to destroy them. Now, that's not real fun language to talk about. But that's what it says. And I think that's part of what God is saying, and His Son is saying in Mark 12. That's recorded for us in Mark 12, that's how He wants us to love Him. I want to show you another verse that's in the New Testament my guess is more than half of this audience can quote the verse I'm about to show you. And if I ask you, what's the emphasis of the verse I'm about to show you, my guess is you'd all say probably the same thing. But I want to point out something different about the verse this morning. This is Romans 8. We know that all things work together for good to those who love God and to those who are called according to His purpose. What's the thing that arrests our attention most about that passage? Most of us would say, all things work together for good if you love the Lord. I think that's what it's saying. I don't think he's saying that everything in your life is working towards something good. I think we miss the point when we make this too broad. I think he's saying that all things that God has done work together for our good. I mean, he's talking about that in that passage. He's not saying everything that happens to me is for my good. I don't think he's saying that. And I think when we say that's what he's saying, I think we misstate what the point is. But he's saying that what God has, all those things that God has done work together for the good, but notice this, to those who love God. It's not, this is to those who love God. And to further qualify it, it's not just those who love God, it's those who are called according to His purpose. That's what this is about. So loving God and having things in my life work out the way that God intends is all about what I do. It's a choice that I make. Now, let's qualify even further what love we're talking about. Because I think that we can narrow down the scope even more. I think that's what He does. So what does that mean? Well, loving God, He says, you got to love Him with what? He says, all your heart. All your heart. And I think as I have looked at this word and I've studied this passage and thought about the phrase and the way it's used, I do think that what He's saying here is that my disposition, how I am disposed, has to be toward God. Has to be toward loving Him. And may I say it this way, and I think this is in the essence. I don't know that it's all about it, but I think this is the essence. I think He is saying you have to have a passion for God. And we can undo what we commonly talk about, well, all the emotionalism that's wrong with religion. Let me tell you something. There is a degree to which I agree with that statement. But there is also a degree to which I very much agree with that statement. That there is a passion that ought to be a part of each of our lives that disposes us toward God and toward loving Him. And so I think that's why Jesus would say, as He's quoting what God His Father would say, that's found in Deuteronomy and other passages, I think that's why He says, you've got to love Me with a passion. And not everybody who's a believer loves God with passion. Not everybody. Not everybody in this assembly this morning, probably, although I don't know that to be the case, is passionate about God. I think that's probably true. But if you're going to love God the way He intends, He says you got to do it with a disposition that says, I'm passionate about You, Lord. And I'm passionate about You more than anything else in my life. I'm passionate about that. And then He says you have to love Him with all your soul. I think the idea is all my being. Our entire being is on display. Our heart, what's within us, involves what we're passionate about, right? There are things that we can say, well, I'm passionate about that. That's what you, okay, we'll use the term. That's what you feel inside. I'm emotional, passion, whatever you want to use. But that's something that comes within. That's how I'm disposed. And now He says, but yet that passion needs to be shown in our lives. It's one thing to say I'm passionate for God. It's a whole other issue to say I'm going to show that. Can we act? We act our passion in every facet of our lives. If our disposition is such that say, I am passionate about God. And again, I'll say this to you. I may be wrong. But loving God with all our soul probably doesn't happen with everybody in this assembly. Probably not. And then He says, you have to love God with all your mind. Now again, I ask you the question, why not just say you got to love God? Why talk about all this? Because all this is a part of it. You have to love God with all your mind. You have to not use as I think Patrick alluded to this morning in the class, don't go back to 1 Corinthians 1 and 2. Don't think about it from a worldly standpoint. Don't let the wisdom of the world dictate how you use your mind. Let your reason, let your ability to comprehend and assimilate and put all that together, let your mind do that. Love Him with all your mind. Don't be afraid. But use the sound reasoning which God has given. It's that wisdom that comes from above, you see. When you start evaluating all that and you reach a sound conclusion using all your mind, That's a good feeling. That helps your heart and your soul when you've studied it and you've said, you know something? I can't help but reach that conclusion. And you've done that, let's say, by using sound reasoning. And then finally, and maybe, not most importantly, they're all equal in terms of importance, I think. But in terms of my understanding of this passage, maybe this has helped me more than any of the four. He says you need to love God with all of your strength. Now, I'm going to tell you something. I'm glad he's not talking about physical strength, because if he would, we'd all be in trouble. He's talking about, it's an interesting word, this idea of strength. He's talking about the idea of using your might. The noun form of this word, it's only used twice in the Old Testament. Interesting. But the adverbial form of the word, the idea of mightily, see, adverb, L-Y, that's what I learned in sixth grade. If it ends in L-Y, it's probably an adverb. But the verb form of that is used almost 300 times in the Old Testament. And the verb form means very. Very hard, very good. We use that term all the time. How you feel? I feel very good. I don't feel very good. I'm feeling bad. I feel very bad. I mean, we use that term all the time, right? So the question then, when he uses this term of strength, what does it mean to love God with all your strength? He says, you need to love God with all your veriness. It's the idea, you see. The Greek word's translated power. The Aramaic term is translated wealth. Power and wealth has to do with what you have. This has to do with not how you feel inside or your whole being. This has to do with practically what do you have. Both words are pointing to the same idea. And loving God with this idea is loving God with everything at your disposal. You see that? Variness. Everything. Loving God with everything at your disposal. In other words, you use your resources to honor God. It's as important as having passion for Him. It's as important as your entire being being devoted to God. It's as important as using sound reason to reach those conclusions. What He's saying is, with all that you have at your disposal, you love God. In whatever way and whatever means you have the power to do. And that right there, folks, that extends past myself. That extends past what's in me and my entire being. That's not about me. That's about how I use what I have, what God has given me. That's what that's about. So to me, you then see that it's not just about loving God. It's about loving God like this. Because this encompasses everything. A lot of people talk about passion. Most people who are religious, they love to talk about passion. That most of them are in assemblies this morning that typically are going to stir their emotion. Nothing wrong with emotion. But if that's all it's about, you don't love God. You love emotion. Because if you love God, you're going to use sound reasoning to determine what it is that He wants. It's not just about stirring you. It's about, here's what He says. And what He says is what stirs me. Not just my passion, but my entire being. That's what stirs me. And so, I reach that based upon using my mind, my cognitive skills, and my ability to understand. Not just because it makes me feel good. I'm going to tell you something right now. If it was just about how I felt about something spiritually, I wouldn't be here today. I'm going to tell you that. There's a lot of places that could excite me more than coming to this assembly. But in the wrong way. I don't want to do it the wrong way. I want to the very best of my ability to do it the right way. And what God says is that's where it's all at. You got to love me with all of your heart. All these ways, you got to love me. What's a challenge then for us? What's our challenge today? Let me put it in some pretty basic terms. It's more than showing up here on a weekly basis. It's so much more than showing up here on a weekly basis. I hate to even say that. I hate to even bring that up. Because that ought to be the easiest conclusion that all of us should reach. It's more than this. Now, he's interested in this. He wants this. I mean, he talks about that. But this is not this. Not exclusively, no. He wants, it's more than having done deeds. It's more than giving money. I want you to think about this, and I'm about finished. He wants us. He wants everything that's listed up here. He wants everything. That's what he's saying. And may I say something to you about all these things? God can't take any of those from us. He can't cause any of those things in us. You see that? He can't make you passionate. He can't make you love Him with your entire being. He cannot make you use sound reasoning. And He cannot make you give everything at your disposal so that He knows you love Him more than anything else. He can't make you do any of these four. Isn't that interesting? It's all a matter of choice. He can't take it from you. He can't beat you over the head and say, "Why don't you see that? And because you don't, I'm going to make you." He doesn't say that. What he says is, "I'm going to keep talking to you about it." Maybe. He's talking to you today through the fact that we've talked about this. Preaching always has involved this concept. But the thing God wants most is us, and it's the one thing He can't take. Think about that. Finally, the last passage. After Jesus has this conversation to the scribe in Mark 12, this is what Mark records the scribe saying. So the scribe said to him, "Well said, teacher." It's like, I'm the scribe, you just Jesus. Well said. "You've spoken the truth, for there is one God, and there is no other but He, and to love Him with all the heart, with all the understanding, with all the soul, and with all the strength, and to love one's neighbor as oneself is more than all the whole burnt offerings and sacrifices." I know there's a second command, but that's not what we're talking about this morning. Now, when Jesus saw that he answered wisely, he said to him, "You're not far from the kingdom of God." In other words, if you'll just apply all that, you're going to be good to go. And I would suggest the same for us this morning. If we'll just apply all that, we'll be good to go. Saved by His mercy, you understand. But we will understand the commitment that it takes for us to love Him like we should. And let me go back one to say one other thing that I've already mentioned twice. Not everybody in the assembly loves God like that. Not everybody in this assembly. I know that because I'm guilty of some of that. But the point of preaching is not only to make us feel guilty when we should, but it's also pointed to help us change when we should. So you have to evaluate yourself, you see. You have to say, "Do I love God like I ought to?" And you have to remember what God said in Deuteronomy 7. If you don't, I'm going to repay you. But if you do, by my mercy, I'm going to reward you. That's what this choice is always about, folks. Always about that. And that's why we sing a song at the close of a sermon like this to encourage you. First of all, because we are to sing and because we do want to encourage anybody that needs to respond. And it may be today that every one of us needs to respond. I mean that. Maybe that all of us need, in some way or another. All of us need to be helped by what we've discussed this morning. But if there is a sense in which you need to respond publicly this morning, maybe you violated the very law that God has given to you and you've rebelled against Him. Well, you need to let Him know first. And let us know that that's not the way you want to live your life anymore. And you can do that now. And you can also come now and give your life to Him and commit to having this love for God that we talked about this morning. You don't have to be perfect. My goodness, if it were all about perfectness, none of us would make it. And I want to stress that. But without it, without your attempt to love Him like you ought to, you have no hope, zero. So we want to offer that to you by God's mercy and grace this morning. If you need to respond, come as we stand and as we sing.